Georges Bataille was born in 1897 in France. He died in 1962. He was the author of multiple works on economics and on sexuality and on how we perceive sexuality in our works of art, in our legends. He wrote The Story of the Eye, which is an incredible work of mad, feverish prose, written in the mid-20s, when he was in his late 20s, I guess. A completely pornographic work. It is oddly not hot in the sense, it's very hot in its descriptions, but it's not something that you would masturbate over. Its sexuality is so detached from itself that one can only stare at it in awe, this book. One major sequence, a priest in a confessional is fucked by our hero and heroine and killed, and his eyes popped out of his head. And while our people are having sex, eyeballs are rolling in the space between their bodies, severed eyeballs. That's not sexy, but it's very sexy. He puts eggs and eyeballs and I don't know, but it begins with them as young teenagers, and the girl raises her skirt and sits her pussy down into a bowl of milk that's set out for the cat. It's so sexy. It's just so bizarrely sexy. So what I'm going to play for you now, I have a couple pieces by Bataille that I would like to share. First is from the mid-30s. It was published in the mid-40s. And it's a work called Blue of Noon. It is a description of decadence. And this is the prologue to Blue of Noon by Georges Bataille.
In London, in a cellar in a neighborhood dive, the most squalid of unlikely places, Dirty was drunk. Utterly so. I was next to her. My hand was still bandaged from being cut by a broken glass. Dirty that day was wearing a sumptuous evening gown. I was unshaven and unkempt. As she stretched her long legs, she went into a violent convulsion. The place was crowded with men, and their eyes were getting ominous. The eyes of these perplexed men recalled spent cigars. Dirty clasped her naked thighs with both hands. She moaned as she bit into a grubby curtain. She was as drunk as she was beautiful. Staring at a gas lamp, she rolled around, irate eyes. "What's going on?" she shouted. In the same instant, like a cannon going off in a cloud of dust, she jumped. From eyes that bulged like a scarecrow's came a stream of tears. She shouted again, "Trotman!" As she looked at me, her eyes opened wider. With long, dirty hands, she stroked my sick head. My forehead was damp from fever. She was crying with wild entreaty the way one vomits. She was sobbing so hard her hair was drenched with tears. The scene that preceded this nauseous carnival, afterwards rats must have come crawling over the floor around the two sprawled bodies, was in every way worthy of Dostoevsky. Drunkenness had committed us to dereliction in pursuit of some grim response to the grimmest of compulsions. Before being wholly affected by drink, we had managed to retreat to a room at the Savoy. Dirty had noticed that the elevator attendant was very ugly. In spite of his handsome uniform, you might have taken him for a grave digger. She pointed this out to me with a distracted laugh. Her speech was already awry. She spoke like a drunk woman. You know, racked as she was by hiccups, she kept stopping short. When I was a kid, I remember I came here with my mother. Here. About 10 years ago, so I must have been 12. My mother was a faded old lady, sort of like the Queen of England. So, as it happened, coming out of the elevator man, we just saw him. Who? Him? Yes. The same one as today. He didn't stop at level. The elevator went up too far. She fell flat on her face. She came tumbling down. My mother, Dirty, burst out laughing like some lunatic. She couldn't stop. Struggling to find my words, I said to her, Don't laugh anymore. You'll never get through your story. She stopped laughing and began shouting, Oh my, I'm getting silly. I'll have to... No. No, I'll finish my story. My mother, not stirring with her skirt over her head, that enormous skirt of hers, like someone dead. Not another stir out of her. They picked her up and began putting her to bed. She started to puke. She was stewed to the eyeballs, except that 1 second earlier you couldn't tell. That woman, she was like a mastiff. She was scary. I said to Dirty abjectly, I'd like to fall down in front of you just the way she did. Would you throw up? Dirty asked me, without even a smile. She kissed me inside the mouth. Maybe. I went into the bathroom. I was very pale. For no reason at all, I looked at myself in the mirror for a long time. I was horribly unkempt, almost coarse, with swollen features that were not even ugly, and the rank look of a man just out of bed. Dirty was alone in the bedroom. It was a huge room lighted by a multitude of ceiling lamps. She wandered around, walking straight ahead as though she would never stop. She seemed literally crazy. Her shoulders were bare to the point of indecency. In that light, I found the glitter of her blonde hair unbearable. She gave me a feeling of purity, nonetheless. Even in her debauchery, there was such candor in her that I sometimes wanted to grovel at her feet. I was afraid of her. I was afraid of her. I saw that she was worn out. She was on the point of falling down. She began gasping for breath, panting like an animal. She was suffocating. Her mean, hunted look was driving me insane. She stopped. I think her legs were squirming under her dress. There was no doubt she was about to start raving. She rang the bell for the maid. After a few moments, a red-haired, fresh-complexioned, and rather pretty maid came in. She seemed to gag on the smell. It was a highly unusual smell for so opulent a place, that of a low-down brothel. Dirty had given up trying to stand on her feet unless she had a wall to lean on. She seemed to be in horrible pain. I don't know at what point in the day she had smothered herself in cheap perfumes, but in addition to the indescribable state she had gotten herself into, she gave off a sour smell of armpit and crotch, which, mingling with the perfume, recalled the stench of an infirmary. She also reeked of whiskey, and she was belching. The English girl was aghast. You're just the person I need, Dirty announced. But first, you have to get the elevator man. There's something I want to tell him. The maid vanished. Dirty, now staggering, went and sat on a chair. With great difficulty, she managed to set down a bottle and a glass on the floor beside her. Her eyes were growing heavy. Her eyes tried to find me. I was no longer there. She lost her head. In a desperate voice, she called out, "Trotman!" There was no reply. She got up and several times nearly fell. She made it to the bathroom door. She saw me slumped on a bench, haggard and white. In my drunkenness, I had just reopened the cut on my right hand. The bleeding, which I was trying to stanch with a towel, was dribbling rapidly onto the floor. Dirty, in front of me, was staring at me with eyes like an animal's. I wiped my face, thus smearing blood over my forehead and nose. The electric light was getting blindingly bright. It was unbearable, this light that wore out the eyes. There was a knock at the door. The maid came in, followed by the elevator attendant. Dirty slumped under the chair. After what seemed to me like a very long time, her eyes lowered and unseeing, she asked the elevator attendant, "You were here in 1924? The attendant answered yes. "I want to ask you, the tall old lady, the one who fell down getting out of the elevator and vomited on the floor. You remember?" Dirty was articulating through dead lips, seeing nothing. In fearful embarrassment, the two servants cast sidelong glances, questioning and observing one another. "I do remember," the attendant admitted. "It's true. This man, who was in his 40s, may have had the face of a thieving gravedigger, but it was of such an unctuosity that it seemed to have been pickled in oil." "A glass of whiskey? Dirty asked. No one answered. The two characters stood there in deferential, painful expectancy. Dirty asked to be given her purse. Her gestures were so sluggish it took a long minute for her hand to reach the bottom of the purse. As soon as she found the stack of banknotes, she tossed it on the floor, saying merely, "Go shares." The gravedigger had found something to do. He picked up the precious stack and began counting out the pounds aloud. There were 20 in all. He handed 10 to the maid. "We may leave?" he asked after a while. "Oh, no. Not yet. Please sit down." She seemed to be suffocating. Blood was rushing to her face. Showing great deference, the two servants had remained standing, but they too became red and anxious, partly because of the staggering size of the tip, partly because of the implausible, incomprehensible situation. Dirty remained mutely perched on the chair. There was a long silence. You could have heard our hearts inside our bodies. I walked over to the door, pale and sick, my face smeared with blood. I was hiccuping and on the point of vomiting. In terror, the servant saw that water was trickling across the chair and down the legs of their beautiful guest, while the urine was gathering into a puddle that spread over the carpet. A noise of slackening bowels made itself ponderously evident beneath the young woman's dress. Beet red, her eyes twisted upwards. She was squirming on her chair like a pig under the knife. The trembling, nauseated maid had to wash Dirty, who seemed calm and content once again. She let herself be wiped and soaped. The elevator man aired the room until the smell had completely disappeared. He then bandaged my cut to stop the bleeding. Things were all back to their proper place. The maid was putting away the last articles of clothing, washed, perfumed, more beautiful than ever. Dirty was stretched out on the bed, still drinking. She made the attendant sit down. He sat next to her in an armchair. At this point, drunkenness gave her the forsaken candor of a child, of a little girl. Even when she remained silent, she seemed forsaken. Occasionally, she would laugh to herself. "Tell me," she said at last to the elevator attendant, "during all the years you've been at the Savoy, you must have had lots of repulsive experiences." "Oh, not all that many," he replied, although not before finishing his whiskey, which seemed to give him a boost and restore his composure. "The guests here are well-behaved, as a rule." "Oh, well-behaved. That's a whole way of life, isn't it? Just like my departed mother when she took a tumble in front of you and puked all over your sleeves, and Dirty burst into dissonant laughter, to which, in that emptiness, there was no response. She went on, "And do you know why they're all well-behaved? They're scared. Do you understand? Their teeth are chattering. That's why they never dare let anything show. I can sense that because I'm scared myself." "Yes, my good man, I am. Can't you tell? Even of you. Scared to death. Wouldn't madam like a glass of water?" the maid asked fearfully. "Shit!" Dirty curtly answered, sticking out her tongue at her. "I happen to be sick. Don't forget that. I also happen to have a few brains in my head." Then, "You don't give a fuck, but things like that make me want to vomit, do you hear?" With a mild gesture, I managed to interrupt her. As I made her take another swallow of scotch, I said to the attendant, "Admit that if it was up to you, you'd strangle her." "You're right," Dirty yelped. "Look at those huge paws, those gorilla's paws of his. They're hairy as balls." As I made her take another swallow of scotch, I said to the attendant, "Admit that if it was up to you, you'd strangle her." "You're right," Dirty yelped. "Look at those huge paws, those gorilla's paws of his. They're hairy as balls." "But, madame," the attendant protested, "you know I'm here to oblige you." "What an idea. No, you idiot, I don't need your balls. I'm feeling sick to my stomach." As she chortled, she belched. The maid dashed out and came back with the basin. She seemed all servility and utterly decent. I sat there pale and listless. I kept drinking more and more. "And as for you, you, the nice girl," Dirty began, this time addressing the maid, "you masturbate, and you look at the teapots and shop windows for when you'll set up housekeeping. If I had a fanny like yours, I'd let everybody see it. Otherwise, one day you'll happen to find a hole while you're scratching and die of shame." Appalled, I abruptly told the maid, "Sprinkle some water on her face. Can't you see she's getting all hot?" The maid immediately started bustling about. She put a wet towel on Dirty's forehead. Dirty dragged herself over to the window. Beneath her, she saw the Thames and in the background some of the most hideous buildings in London, now magnified in the darkness. She quickly vomited in the open air. In her relief, she called for me, and as I held her forehead, I stared at that foul sewer of a landscape, the river and the warehouses. In the vicinity of the hotel, the lights of luxury apartments loomed insolently. Gazing out at London, I almost wept, I was so distraught with anxiety. As I breathed in the cool air, childhood memories of little girls, for instance, with whom I used to play at telephone and Diabolo, merged with the vision of the elevator attendant's ape-like paws. What was happening, moreover, seemed to me trivial and somehow ludicrous. I myself was empty. I was scarcely even capable of inventing new horrors to fill the emptiness. I felt powerless and degraded. It was in this uncompliant and indifferent frame of mind that I followed Dirty outside. Dirty kept me going. Nevertheless, I could not conceive of any human creature more derelict and adrift. This anxiety that never for a moment let the body slacken provided the only explanation for a wonderful ability. We managed with no respect for conventional pigeonholes to eliminate every possible urge in the room at the Savoy as well as in the dive, wherever we had to.
That was The Blue of Noon, prologue by George Bataille. That continues on. The novel has just begun. The next story I'm going to read for you is from about 1943. In the notes, Bataille has forgotten exactly when he wrote it. He was in France. The war was going on. He had a mistress that he would ride his bicycle to see. He was living in the countryside. Normally, Bataille was a French national librarian. But when Hitler had power in France, he escaped to the seaside and lived quietly there to try to not cause trouble. But his mind was still going. And this was not published until after his death. It was written in the tiniest of print on small sheets of paper, right? And in little blocks of print, so that it has to be set up in a format so you can see the way he wrote it. And yet it is an amazing story. About a guy dies and the girl who's there watching goes crazy. And this is very much pornographic. But again, I don't know how sexy it is. How sexy is it to have a dwarf being masturbated while the girl pisses in his face? This is called The Dead Man. And I leave it up to you as to what it all means. By George Bataille, here on Kill Radio and The Chill Room.
When Edouard fell back dead and emptiness opened inside her, a prolonged shudder went through her and bore her upward like an angel. Her bare breasts were rising in a church seen in a dream where the feeling of the irreparable was draining her. Standing by the dead, transported, overcome in a slow ecstasy, smitten, she knew herself to be desperate, but she was throwing her despair to the winds. As he was dying, Edouard had beseeched her to take off her clothes. She had been unable to do it in time. There she stood, disheveled, yanking at her dress. Only her bosom had popped into view. Time had just set at nothing the laws to which fear subjects us. She took off her dress and hung her coat over one arm. She was out of her mind and naked. She rushed out and ran in the night under the downpour. Her shoes clattered in the mud. The rain drenched her. She felt a need to move her bowels, held back against it. Come to a wood, she lay down amidst the soothing mildness of trees. She pissed against the earth, the urine wetting her legs. Upon the ground, quietly, in an absurd voice, crazily, she sang, "My naked, nakedness, positive atrociousness." Then she rose, put on her raincoat, and ran through Quilly until she got to the door of the inn. Intimidated, she hesitated in front of the door, lacking the courage to enter. Shouts, the drunken singing of girls and men could be heard coming from within. She felt herself tremble, but from her trembling drew pleasure. "I shall go in," she thought. "They shall see me naked." She had to lean against the wall. She opened her coat and slid her long fingers into her crack. She listened, stiffened by excitement. Upon her fingers, she smelled the odor of unwashed sex. Inside the inn, there was a loud uproar. Even so, all was still. Rain fell, driven by a tepid wind blowing through a cellar-like darkness. A girl sang. It was a working-class song and sad, heard outside in the night. The voice, low-pitched and muffled by the walls, was heartrending. It ceased. Applause and the stamping of feet followed it, then cheers. Marie sobbed in the dark. She wept in her helplessness, the back of her hand pressed against her teeth. Knowing she would enter, Marie trembled. She opened the door, advanced 3 steps into the room. A draft blew the door shut at her back. She recalled having dreamt of that door slamming forever shut behind her. Farmhands, the mistress of the inn, and some girls were gazing at her. She stood motionless in the entry, mud spattered, hair dripping, and ugliness in her glance. She appeared to have risen from the gusts of the night. The wind was to be heard outside. Her coat was covering her, but she opened it at the neck. In a low voice, she asked if she could drink. "A brandy?" asked the mistress from behind the bar. She put a glass on the counter and filled it. That was not what Marie wanted. "A bottle and some big glasses," she said. Subdued as before, her voice was firm. "I'll drink with them," she added. She paid. A farmhand in muddy boots addressed her shyly. "Did you come to have some fun?" "That's it," said Marie. She tried to smile. The smile sawed her face. She stationed herself next to the boy, pressed her leg against his, and taking his hand, placed it between her thighs. "For Christ's sake," moaned the boy when he touched her crack. The others flushed, kept still. One of the girls came over, drew aside a skirt of the coat. "Just look at that," she said. "Nothing on." Marie let them go ahead and quickly drowned down a glass of alcohol. "She really laps it up," said the mistress. A bitter belch was Marie's reply. "That's it," Marie said sorrowfully. Strands of wet black hair clung to her face. She shook her pretty head, straightened up, removed her coat. A husky fellow who was drinking at the farther end of the room started toward her, lurching, his waving arms outflung. "Snatch," he brayed. "This way with the snatch. I'll snatch you," the mistress darted at him, and she caught hold of his nose and tweaked it. He let out a yell. "No," said Marie. "Here's where you get a better hold." She went up to the drunk and unbuttoned his fly. The cock she brought to light slumped uncertainly. The sight of it produced laughter all around. Just like that, bold as you please, Marie knocked off another glass. Gently, eyes peering like searchlights, the mistress touched her behind at the divide. "Makes your mouth water," she said. Marie filled her glass once again. The brandy went clucking down. She swigged to kill. The glass fell from her hand. Her behind was colorless and deep cleft. Its sweetness shed a glow throughout the room. One of the peasants standing off to one side, a look of hatefulness on his face. An overly handsome man. He was wearing high rubber boots, a little too new. Marie came up to him, bottle in hand. She was tall and flushed. Her legs were shaky inside her loosening stockings. The young man took the bottle and swigged. Then, in a loud voice, aggressively, he barked, "All right, that's enough," and banged the empty bottle down hard on the table. Marie asked him whether he had something else in mind. He smiled by way of answer. He seemed to feel he had it made with her. He wound up the player piano. When he returned, he lifted his arms and struck a pose, shuffled his feet. He looped a hand around Marie. They danced an obscene wiggle. Marie threw herself into it, body and soul, revolted, her head flung back. Suddenly the mistress rose. "Pierrot!" she cried. Marie was falling. The handsome young man lost his hold upon her, stumbled. The slender body which had slipped away landed on the floor with a dull thud. "Whew!" said Pierrot. "The bitch." He wiped his cuff across his mouth. The mistress hurried over. She knelt and raised Marie's head carefully. Saliva, or rather drool, spilled from her mouth. A girl arrived with a moistened napkin. Marie came to in a moment or so. She asked weakly for some brandy. "Get a glass," the mistress ordered one of the girls. A glass was fetched. She drank. Then she asked for more. The girl refilled the glass. Marie took it from her hand. She drank as if she were short of time. Resting in the mistress's and one of the girls' arms, she raised her head. "Another one," she said. The farmhands, the girls and mistress of the inn surrounding Marie, waited for what she was about to say. Marie murmured but one word. "Dawn," she said. Then her head slumped heavily. She looked awful. Awful. "What did she say?" the mistress asked. Nobody knew what to answer. Then the mistress spoke to the handsome Pierrot. "Suck her." "How about if we put her on a chair?" one girl wondered. Then together, several of them picked the body up and propped it in a sitting position upon the chair. Pierrot, having gotten down on his knees, hoisted her legs so that they rested upon his shoulders. The good-looking kid flashed a conquering smile and stuck his tongue in amidst the hairs. Sick, illuminated, Marie seemed happy. She smiled without opening her eyes. She felt herself alight, chilled, but voiding it without stint sensed her life void itself into the gutter. An unavailing desire kept her under strain. She would have liked to relieve herself. She imagined what a fright that would cause the others. She no longer felt sundered from Edouard. Her cunt and her ass exposed, the smell of moist ass and moist cunt were setting her inwardly free, and Pierrot's tongue, which was wetting her, gave her the impression of the chill of death. Sodded on alcohol and tears and weeping not, she inhaled that chill open mouth, drew the mistress's head to hers, unto decay, opening the abyss of delight formed by her lips. Marie thrust the mistress away and beheld that head, its hair askew, its features disordered by joy. Sweet drunkenness gave a radiance to the virago's face. She too was drunk, singing drunk. Devout tears gathered in her eyes. Regarding those tears and seeing nothing, Marie breathed, bathing in the light of death. "I am thirsty," said she. Pierrot was sucking away like a house afire. The mistress hastily tendered her a bottle. Marie swilled long draughts and drained it. A scurry, a shriek of terror, a crashing of broken bottles, a frog-like jerking of Marie's thighs, commotion amongst the shouting youths. The mistress helped Marie to lie down upon the seat. Her eyes remained vacant, enraptured. Wind, squalls raged outside. Shutters were banging in the night. "Listen," said the mistress. A howling of wind in the trees was heard, sustained and wailed like a mad woman's call. The door at that moment flew wide open. A blast blew into the room. The naked Marie was on her feet in a trice. She screamed, "Edouard!" And the anguish in it made her voice one with the voice of the wind. From out of that evil night, a man emerged. Struggling to close an umbrella, his rat-like silhouette stood out sharply in the doorway. "Quick, my lord," said the mistress. "Come in quick." She swayed. Without replying, the dwarf-sized count walked in. "You are soaked to the skin," the mistress went on, shutting the door. There was a startling momentousness to the little man, broad and hunchbacked, his large head nested between his shoulders. He greeted Marie solemnly, then turned to the farm workers. "Good evening, Pierrot," said he, shaking hands with him. "Help me out of my coat, if you will." Pierrot helped the count rid himself of his coat. The count pinched his leg. Pierrot smiled. The count distributed amiable handshakes. "You will allow me?" he asked, making a bow. He seated himself at Marie's table. Opposite her, the count called for some bottles. "I've drunk so much," said one girl, "that I'm pissing on my chair." "Drink till you shit, dear child," and he broke off there, rubbing his hands, not without an air of detachment.
Marie sat still, looking at the Count, and her head swam. "Poor," said she. The Count filled the glasses. Then she resumed, and in a very sober manner, "I'm going to die at dawn." The Count's steel-blue gaze scanned her. His blonde eyebrows rose, deepening the wrinkles upon an excessively broad forehead. Marie raised her glass and said, "Drink up." The Count raised his glass too and drank. Together they downed their drinks at one swallow. The mistress came and took a seat beside Marie. "I am afraid," Marie told her. Her eyes remained fastened upon the Count. Something like a hiccup shook her. In an uncontrolled voice, she murmured in the older woman's ear, "It's the ghost of Edward." "What Edward?" the mistress inquired in a whisper. "He is dead," Marie replied in the same whisper. She caught the other's hand in hers and bit it. "Bitch!" complained the bitten woman. But pulling her face free, she caressed Marie, and as she kissed her shoulder, said to the Count, "She's nice all the same." Now it was the Count who asked, "Who is Edward?" "You don't know who you are anymore," said Marie. With that, her voice had broken. "Make him drink," she besought the mistress. She appeared near to collapse. The Count tossed off his glass, but then he said, "Alcohol doesn't do much for me." The solid little man with the oversized head rested a bleak eye upon Marie, as if it were his intention to make her uncomfortable. Whatever he looked at, it was in that same way, his head stiff between his shoulders. "Pierrot!" he called. The farmhand drew near. "This young thing," said the dwarf, "is getting a rise out of me. Would you care to sit down here?" The youth, once seated, the Count went on blithely, "Be a good lad, Pierrot. Take me in hand. I don't dare ask this child to do it." He smiled. "Unlike you, she's not accustomed to monstrosities." At that point, Marie climbed upon the seat. "I'm scared," said Marie. "You look like a tombstone." He made no reply. Pierrot took hold of his member. For impassiveness, he did indeed resemble something of stone. "Go away," said Marie, "or I'll piss on you if you don't." She climbed onto the table and squatted. "You'll see me delighted if you do," the monster rejoined. There was no play to his neck, only his chin moved when he spoke. Marie pissed. Vigorously, Pierrot wanked the Count, who received the urine full in the face. The Count reddened and urine flowed over him. Pierrot's frigging was worth a fucking, and the cock spat seed up the front of the waistcoat. In his throes, the dwarf was racked by little shudders, which made him jump from head to toe. Marie kept on pissing. On the table amidst the bottles and glasses, she sopped herself with urine she caught in her hands. She had it running down her legs, her ass, and her face. "Look," she said, "I'm a lovely sight." Crouched, her cunt level with the monster's head, she spread its lips horribly. A venomous smile came over Marie's face. A sinister, a nasty sight. One of her feet slipped. They collided, her cunt against the Count's face. He lost his balance and fell, both tumbling, yelling to the floor amidst an incredible fracas. On the floor, a dreadful wrestling ensued. Marie went berserk, got her teeth into the Count's cock. The Count howled. Pierrot hauled her away, pinned her at the wrists, her arms outflung. The others had hold of her legs. "Let me go," Marie wailed. Then she was silent. Finally, it was all she could do to fight for her breath, her eyes shut. She opened her eyes. Pierrot, red-faced, sweating, was on top of her. "Fuck me," she said. "Stick her, Pierrot," the mistress said. They bustled around the victim. Hemmed in by these preparations, Marie let her head subside. The others stretched her out flat, spread her legs apart. She was breathing rapidly. Her breathing was noisy. In its slow unfolding, the scene recalled the slaughtering of a pig or the laying to rest of a god. Pierrot, once out of his trousers, the Count required that he remove everything else too. The youth came on like a bull. The Count helped the pizzle enter. The victim thrashed and fought, a hand-to-hand combat, unbelievably bitter. The others watched, dry-mouthed, astounded by this frenzy. The bodies linked by Pierrot's dick rolled upon the floor, struggling. At last, his back straining like a bow fully bent, the breathless boy let out a yell, foaming. Marie answering his shot with the spasm of one dying. Marie returned to her senses. She heard birds singing in the boughs of a grove. The songs, infinitely delicate, flitted with a swish from tree to tree. Lying in the wet grass, she saw that the sky was clear. Day was at that moment beginning to break. She felt cold, gripped by an icy happiness, suspended in an unintelligible emptiness. Even though she sought gently to raise her head, and though she sank back from exhaustion upon the ground, she remained faithful to the light, to the foliage, to the birds thronging the wood. For a brief instant, childhood timidities rose in her memory. She beheld, bending over her, the large and solid head of the Count. What Marie read in the eyes of the dwarf was the insistence of death. That face expressed only an infinite disenchantment, rendered cynical by a frightful obsession. Hatred surged up in her, and as death drew near, she was very afraid. She got up, gritting her teeth opposite the kneeling monster. Upon her feet, she trembled. She backed off, stared at the Count, and vomited. "You see," she said. "Feel better?" the Count asked. "No," she replied. She saw the vomit in front of her. Her torn coat covered her hardly at all. "Where are we going?" "To your house," the Count told her. "To my house?" groaned Marie. Again she felt dizzy. "Are you the devil, wanting to go to my house?" she asked. "Yes," the dwarf replied. I've sometimes been told I was the devil." "The devil?" said Marie. "I shit in front of the devil." "You vomited a moment ago." "I'll shit now." She squatted and shat upon the vomit. The monster was still upon his knees. Marie leaned back against an oak tree. She was sweating. Her teeth chattered. She said, "All that, it doesn't amount to anything at all. But in my house, you're going to get a scare. You'll see. Too late." She nodded her head, then strode fiercely over to the dwarf, seized him by the collar, and shouted, "Are you coming?" "Willingly," said the dwarf, and he added, almost in a whisper, "We're two of a kind." Marie, who had heard what he said, gazed candidly at the Count. He stood up. "Never," he murmured, "does anyone speak to me in that manner." "You can go away, it's up to you," she said. "But if you come..." The Count interrupted her sharply. "I am coming with you. You are going to give yourself to me." Her mood was still angry. "It's high time," she said. "Come on." They walked at a brisk pace. The sun was coming up when they arrived. Marie pushed the gate. They went down a lane flanked by old trees whose crests were lit by golden sunshine. Despite the vile mood she was in, Marie knew she was in agreement with the sun. She led the Count to her bedroom. "It's all over," she said to herself. She was at once weary, full of hatred, indifferent. "Undress yourself," she told him. "I shall be waiting for you in the next room." The Count undressed himself unhurriedly. The rays of sunlight coming through the leaves stippled the wall, and the bright flecks were dancing. The Count was aroused. His cock was long and ruddy. His naked body and that cock had a devilish deformity. His face, bracketed between those angular and too high shoulders, was pale and mocking. He desired Marie and confined his thoughts to this desire. He came through the door, wanly naked, She stood waiting for him beside the bed, tempting and ugly. Drunkenness and fatigue had beaten her. "What's wrong?" Marie asked. The dead man, in disorder, was claiming all the space in the bedroom. "I didn't know," the Count stammered faintly. He groped, clutched at a piece of furniture. His erection was failing. Marie wore a ghastly grin. "It's over with," she said. There was a stupid look about her as she showed a broken glass ampoule in her right hand. Then, at last, she fell. At last, the Count caught sight of the two hearses, proceeded slowly to the cemetery, one behind the other. The dwarf hissed between his teeth, "Foiled." He did not see the canal and slipped down into it. A heavy splash momentarily disturbed the silence of the water. The sunshine remained.
L is for the way you look at me. O is for the only one I see. V is very, very extraordinary. E is even more than anyone that you adore can love, is all that I can give to you. Love is more than just a game for two. Two in love can make it. Take my heart and please don't break it. Love was made for me and you. Is for the only one I see. V is very, very extraordinary. E is even more than anyone that you adore can love. Is all that I can give to you. Love is more than just a game for two. Two. Love can't make it. Take my heart and please don't break it. Love was made for me and you. Love was made for me and you. Love was made for me and you.
That was Nat King Cole doing L-O-V-E, one of the last recordings of his. And before that was a reading of The Dead Man by George Bataille. What do you say about that? I guess the best response is to play something. This is Merzbau and Kaputte Musik. Kaputte Musik means broken music. Merzbau is Masami Akita, a Japanese artist who's been recording for about 25 years. And this is an amazing piece. I guess, I don't know if it's not performed together. It's the two of them treating each other's recordings and sharing them back and forth. It's called Continuum, here in the Chill Room on Kill Radio. We'll be right back. Mesmer's Bow and Capote Music Continuum. A night of extremes. I'll be back next week. This has been the Chill Room on Kill Radio.